Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on Anishinaabe territory, home of the Fort William First Nation at CILU in Thunder Bay. In this episode,
they heard from community today, and it's very clear from community that community wants support and funding for BQI and Blackness. Yes, they want removal of police floats and pride. They want a pride that goes back to the roots of politics.
Interviews with Black Lives Matter and Pride Toronto following a Pride town hall.
For as long as they've been there, they have never been allowed in our territory. We've never given that consent.
And live coverage from the Cleansing Our Waters rally in Vancouver. But first, here are the headlines.
Tonsi, Nitotimatic, this is Lindsay Nixon, and this is CKUT's news header.
Inmates in the U.S. are planning the largest prison strike in U.S. history today, on September 9th, and will stop working in a nationally coordinated prisoner strike. In 1971, prisoners at an Attica prison in New York started a riot on September 9th, fighting for better living conditions. This day has become renowned among prisoners as a day of resistance. The prisoners have told their allies on the outside, this is an attempt to end slavery in prisons. What Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow. The prison system is meant to control and discipline Black and other minority communities of color, says Alexander. It's the most successful project of racialized police targeting since slavery. In a visual document for the NIB, Sophie Louise Dam cites that, while the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, it holds 25% of the world's incarcerated peoples. Black peoples in America are incarcerated at 6 times the rate of white Americans. This has been widely associated with Reagan's so-called war on drugs, which some have described as actually a war on Black people. Since 1982, the U.S. prison population went from 30,000 to 2 million in less than 30 years. In Montreal, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee and the Organizing Committee for Detained Workers have written a statement in solidarity with the strikers. The groups say that private companies in the U.S. rely on the labor of detained workers in federal and state prisons. This slave labor is actually an integral part of the U.S. economy. The group says that conditions in prisons in Canada are just as deplorable and hope to convey solidarity across borders and walls.
Youth who feel safe at school are successful in their studies. This comes from research conducted by the University of Ottawa and Concordia. The project followed over 2,000 babies from 5 months of age until high school to investigate whether feeling unsafe at school interferes with classroom engagement. The researchers also asked how students were impacted emotionally and in their behavior. What did the study find out? Researchers say the data confirms that being a victim of school violence and feeling unsafe both contributes to symptoms of depression. This can be harmful to students' learning potential. Professor Caroline Fitzpatrick, one of the study's lead researchers affiliated with Concordia University, had this to say about the research outcome.
We found that students who felt safer were more attentive and efficient in the classroom. We need increased monitoring of students' reaction and response to incidents of bullying and violence. Through continued professional education, we can also increase teachers' awareness of the importance of feelings of safety, as well as their understanding of how the wider school climate can improve engagement.
The study is available in the journal of Adolescent Health. This headline was produced by CKUT Radio in Montreal.
The Heritage Minister received a letter on September 9th from anti-racist groups addressing allegations of racism within the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunication Commission. The letter also calls for the reconsideration of the recent dismissal of the CRTC Commissioner for the Ontario region. Groundwire asked one of the letter's signatories, Christiana Clemens, president of CMAC, about the motivation behind the letter.
The Community Media Advocacy Center and the Urban Alliance on Race Relations have written to Heritage Minister Jolie concerning the dismissal of CRTC Commissioner Raj Shoen in June for reasons which haven't been disclosed. As court proceedings regarding Shoen's experience with the commission unfold, serious allegations of systemic and overt racism are emerging. We are asking the minister and governor and council to reconsider Shoen's dismissal. We're also requesting that an independent process be initiated to investigate racism within the commission, that anti-racism training be provided for commissioners and staff, and that the commission establish equitable representation for people of color and Indigenous people. In the nearly 50 years that the CRTC has existed, people of color have comprised fewer than 2% of the commissioners appointed, despite making up nearly 20% of Canada's population. This is clearly inequitable.
This headline was produced by CKUT Radio in Montreal for Groundwire.
The final headline of this episode is brought to you by Catherine Fisher and Sienna Drake of CJLY Nelson.
On July 27, 2013, a truck driving through the Slocan Valley took a wrong turn onto Lemon Creek Road. Unknowingly off-path, it continued along a road unfit for a vehicle of its size, even passing two road-closed signs along the way. The tanker truck finally rolled off this road, dumping 35,000 liters of jet fuel into Lemon Creek. 1,300 people were evacuated later that night from the Slocan Valley as the jet fuel traveled from Lemon Creek into the Slocan River. Now, 3 years later, the company and the provincial government are being taken to court over this terrible incident. 8 charges have been filed in total, and these charges have been laid against the company, the province, and the driver of the vehicle. And if you're interested in seeing how this case unfolds in real time, it is occurring at the Nelson Courthouse on September 13th.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Center of the earth, enter in the entrance of rebirth. Remember to remember is to enter in reverse to the center of the center of the center of the dot and disperse. Rubber like circles that abound from a doubt, from a drop to the circles that surround it. In the water make waves and we drown it. Waves the sound that we bathe in, then wash up on this ground and round it. We all stand on it, we all stand for the process that we hang on. Hang on, hang on, hang on like dot, dot, dot. It's like a rock dropped in the water submerged but first reverberates like words that make circle shapes. Circles like records that revolve with grooves that rest and unrest and then resolve when they drop. Little dots like drops of sand from a clock spanning across the canyon, across plots of land like clocks. All we got's is hands to bang together these plots and plans and pots and pans.
You just heard Center from Tanya Tagok's upcoming album Retribution featuring Shad. Now it's time for our feature stories. Back in July, Black Lives Matter protested the police presence in Pride Toronto. Mick Sweetman of CJRU now brings us coverage from a recent Pride Toronto town hall meeting.
On August 30th, hundreds of people attended a Pride Toronto town hall meeting where the discussion centered on Black Lives Matter Toronto's demand that police no longer be allowed to have floats or booths at the festival. At the meeting, the board members of Pride Toronto sat silently at the front of the room, listening to people address them at the open mic. The next day, I sat down with one of Pride's co-chairs to talk about what she heard from the community. We're joined here today with Alika Hall, who is one of the co-chairs of Pride Toronto. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
At the first town hall meeting, things got a little heated. Can I ask what your thoughts are having watched that town hall meeting play out last week?
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of things yesterday that gave us pause and food for thought. I think it's just thinking through what processes and mechanisms we can put in place to ensure that people do feel like how they feel, what they think about Pride, what they want to see more of is actually reflected in there. Because I think that we don't have as many opportunities as we'd like to actually engage with community beyond the festival. And so creating additional spaces and as well as processes and ways for people to just contribute, I think will be really key for us moving forward.
One of the things that you said at the first town hall was that demand around police floats and booths was going to be treated as a complaint and dealt with in the dispute resolutions committee. Can you tell me why the board chose to use that process?
So the dispute resolution process was actually created for this exact scenario, when a group or an individual has a complaint or concern about the participation of another group in the Pride Parade. So I think as an organization, we would rely on a mechanism that was created by both community members as well as with the support of council and in consultation with the City of Toronto's policies to use a mechanism that already exists for our organization and has been actually used a number of times in the past year, as opposed to embarking on a process to do something differently or new.
One of the more specific demands around Pride Toronto was that Pride Toronto double the funding for Blockorama. Is that something that Pride Toronto is prepared to do?
Yes, that's something that Pride Toronto wants to do. And the organization, Pride Toronto, as I said today and yesterday at both town halls, is fully committed to working with Black queer organizations to do that.
One theme that kept reemerging at the meeting was that people were calling on Pride to return to its activist roots. Those roots are the confrontational protests of the bathhouse raids in 1981, where hundreds of people stood up against the Toronto Police's mass arrest of gay people. Today, Gary Kinsman joins us. He is a gay activist and historian and was a founding member of the Lesbian and Gay Pride Day Committee in 1981. Thank you for joining us today, Gary.
Glad to be here.
Why was it important for you to attend this meeting and to speak to that experience?
To remind people that Pride in Toronto, to celebrate the Stonewall Rebellions, was in the context of resistance to the police repression of the Bath Raids in 1981, that demonstration, that first Pride march, and it was a march then, not a parade, was highly political, with people stopped outside the 52 Division headquarters, which was the police headquarters that actually had been largely responsible for the Bath Raids, to basically say, F you, 52. I was the head marshal, or what I usually would like to refer to as marshmallow, for that event. I got in a lot of problems with the cops because, of course, we weren't supposed to stop, right? You're not supposed to stop, and you're not supposed to be, you know, directing your sort of political protest against the police. So they were very upset about that. So I remember that quite well. So what is important to me is to bring that historical context back to 2016. Is as long as the police are continuing to engage in repression and violence against queer people who are homeless and poor, sex workers, Black people of color, Indigenous people, they should not be present within our marches and parades.
Rodney Duvalis is a co-founder of Black Lives Matter Toronto. I spoke with him after the meeting ended. One of the things that the co-chair said today is that the demand that the police participation be removed from Pride is going to be treated in under their dispute resolution process. Were you aware of this, and what's your response to that?
We were not aware of that. I mean, like that's a reality that's coming up to us right now. For me, my thing is, you know, what's the point of having these town halls, actually? What's the point of actually asking hundreds of people to take time out of their schedule to come to talk about something that clearly we all know what we're talking about, if this process actually doesn't have any meaning or any teeth whatsoever? So, yes, there's a dispute resolution process that exists that actually I can't talk about because I don't know what it is. I don't think any of us here in the space know actually what happens, or what it is, or what results of it, or what the process is. But what I do know is that hundreds of people came here and clearly voiced their support for the BLMTO demands, and clearly are asking for change and asking for some action from Pride Toronto. That is actually what should be priority, is that the community, Pride has said that the community, they need to hear from community. They heard from community today, and it's very clear from community that community wants support and funding for BQI and Blackness. Yes, they want removal of police floats and Pride. They want a Pride that goes back to the roots of politics and community-driven queer activism. That is very clear, and I think that Pride Toronto, whether or not they go through the dispute resolution process or not, they can't actually come back and say that this wasn't made clear for them.
Do you feel at all that the focus on whether the police will have floats in Pride or boost in Pride is at all a distraction from the other issues of police violence?
It's not. I don't see it as a distraction, because I think that anytime we're having a conversation about the uselessness of police, it's a good conversation. Pride provides a perfect opportunity to have that, because the police presence at Pride is quite bold, actually. It's quite unapologetic. It's quite in your face. They've even said it themselves. Over 10 floats. There are more representation from police than there are for student groups, than there are for labor, than there are for other community groups.
While there were some people at the meeting who argued that Pride Toronto should continue to welcome police participation, the vast majority of speakers at the town hall were in favor of supporting all of Black Lives Matter Toronto's demands. For CGRU 1280 AM in Toronto, I am Mick Sweetman.
Delegates from the Mushkawa Zwoyedino and scientist Alexandra Morton departed Campbell River on August 29th aboard the Sea Shepherd, linking arms to assert Indigenous rights and opposition to fish farms on the coastal communities including Comox, Nanaimo, Victoria, and finally Vancouver. Gennarji O'Sullivan of Vancouver Co-op Radio brings us live coverage of the Cleansing Our Waters rally that took place on Monday, September 5th.
I've been covering the struggle against fish farms, in particular Cleansing Our Waters, as nations link arms to arms against fish farms. The Sea Shepherd has been traveling with hereditary chiefs of the Musqueam/Tsleil-Waututh in collaboration with the Sea Shepherds, and Alex Morton, of course, and David Suzuki has been seen on the Martin Sheen ship along with Pamela Anderson. They are all calling for your support as they assert as in assertion of our Indigenous rights.
Today I feel very great and honored to be on Musqueam territory. To see all of you out here supporting a good cause. It was well said by the Musqueam people there that we need to take back our ownership. We were brought up that way to take care of our waters, our land, Mother Earth. And it's well proven that the government can't do it. Allowing these fish farms to be in our territory. In order for this to happen, we need to all link arms, come together, and become one, and we will not be defeated. Yes.
Good afternoon. My English name is Willie Moon. I am the elected chief counselor of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation. But I also carry the name in our big house, Oquelagamit. Today, this is the end of our rally, but we ain't going to stop fighting with the fish farms. When we made this stand a month ago, we said we want those fish farms out of our traditional territories and ceded territories. The government nor the industry has ever come and talk to us and ask to be in our territories. So our message today to the government and to the fish farming industry is get out. Over the past few months, DFO has been writing to us in our community saying we want to put some of your fish into SARS. My message to DFO, that the day you get those parasites, what you call fish farms, out of our territory, then you come talk to us about SARS. And I think about the years that we've been on this earth. We've gone through so much, residential school, and now the government has found another way of genocide to our people. You know, we all along the coast live and breathe and eat the salmon. When that is gone, we are gone as people. So this is why we have taken that journey to come down here and ask to link arms with all the other nations, and so that we can send a message to Trudeau, Christy Clark, that it's time that they start to listen to us as First Nations people. And so hopefully today, so I'm hoping today that Christy Clark is listening, and also Justin Trudeau and the DFO minister. And I once again reiterate, and I've said this over our course of our travels, is that they need to come and meet with us and talk to our nation. So hopefully today they hear that call. Hey, look at us.
We, as a quick note, have been
we've been fighting this for a long, long time, and we go back to our late chief, Peter and Alice Smith, who did not want the fish farms. So they did not have free and prior consent to come into our area. They did not. We've never, ever allowed that for as long as they've been there. They have never been allowed in our territory. We've never given that consent.
As you know, we are here to represent the Musquamaw Unit of the West Coast of the Broughton Archipelago area. One-third of their fish farms are in our territory, and we don't want them there anymore. They've been there for too long. And we are really worried now that the damage that they are doing will be irreversible, and there will be nothing we can do about it if we wait any longer. I've been out in our territories, and I noticed that our clam beds are being damaged. There are very few salmon coming back to our rivers. Okay. We are here doing this for our future generations and for your children as well as ours.
Thank you to Gennardi O'Sullivan, Charmaine Barr, Kristen E. Martin, and Corey Alfred for the audio from the live stream used in that report. Now it's time for our community radio report.
On August 29th, CIBL launched an all-new programming format. Founded as a campus community radio station in the 1970s, today CIBL 101.5 FM is the loudest and oldest Francophone community radio station on air in Montreal. After months of preparation and in response to financial crisis, CIBL canceled all programs to launch a new format. Groundwire spoke with CIBL's Director of Programming, Marie-Ève Pinault. She explained the context for this decision.
You've been at CIBL for more than 7 years. Maybe you can talk about the financial situation that CIBL was in. And some of the new programming initiatives that you're taking to alleviate or respond to some of these financial difficulties.
Ouais. CIBL a toujours eu des problèmes financiers depuis le début de son histoire.
She stated that CIBL has had financial problems ever since the beginning of its history. Marie-Ève mentions the station had cheaper rent before, but for the last 4 years, CIBL has paid 12 times its previous monthly rent for the station's new location. This combined with general economic crisis, the crisis in media, the decrease in revenues from granting agencies, plus the decrease in advertising revenues, combined with increased rent and taxes for the new location, contributed to the mounting debt of CIBL. After funding campaigns failed to reach station goals, the station management changed strategies.
We understand that there has been many contributions to the financial situation at CIBL. In the last few months, there's been news about new subventions, new money coming into CIBL, but you've also taken some new programming initiatives. Can you talk about those?
Avant, c'était 80, il y avait 82 émissions.
Marie-Ève tells us, before, the station had 82 programs, some on air for 30 years. As of August, she says, CIBL canceled all the programming because of the complications for audiences to listen to the diverse format of the community radio station. Today, the station invites programmers to join groups to produce around 5 focus areas. She says these include a morning show, the drive-home show, weekend mornings, and Friday night shows, with music and fluid programming in between. This meets the habits of radio listeners, according to Marie-Ève. Programmers are also invited to produce capsules or segments that touch on all the subjects previously aired on CIBL. With this format, Marie-Ève believes CIBL can collaborate with the community in a different way.
On continue de traiter tous les sujets qu'on avait déjà à CIBL. C'est juste la collaboration des gens, de la communauté se fait différemment.
According to Marie-Ève, some 30 volunteers did not return to the station since the programming change. But she added more than 200 volunteers are part of the new format. Groundwire was unable to confirm comment from those volunteers who did not return. In the month before the programming change, CIBL announced a new funding contribution of $375,000 from Cogeco, one of the largest owners of radio stations in Montreal. Martin Bougie, executive director of the Quebec Community Radio Association, explained to Groundwire that the new contribution CIB accessed is a precedent for community radio stations in Canada.
First, it's important to know that CCD, Canadian Content Development, is an envelope in which private broadcaster have to put a certain percentage of their revenues in. Certain percentage goes to Factor, Musique Action, another to Canadian Radio Fund, and there is a portion of this that is discretionary. It means that it's up to the broadcaster to use it as they want, as long as it is compliant with the objectives and parameters of the CCD. So this funding of Cogeco to CIBL is part of this discretionary approach. It has been rubber stamped by the CRTC, so they wanted to make sure that this approach was going along with all the objectives. And it's important to say that there's no strings attached to this deal. It's really discretionary funding for helping the station to develop, to continue to develop and produce local original content.
With regard to the arrangements that have been made, specifically in the case of CIBL, if we step back and look at that for the community radio sector in Quebec or community radio sector as a whole in all of Canada, is this new arrangement, you know, given that it's a first, is it a change in the sense that we now have the private sector subsidizing the community radio sector?
Well, it is certainly an approach that has not been seen in this form. And I would not put it like private sector subsidizing community radio, because, as I said, there's no strings attached. So it's an interesting experience if we talk about the pros for the whole sector in Canada, in the sense that community radio are doing a lot of job in training and giving first experiences. For me, it goes in a logic to say that we play this role, and being supported at the end of the day also benefits the private broadcasters from this. A good, healthy community radio is good for everybody because of the role we play, not just in training, but also in the contents and everything.
And every new opportunity also has its restrictions, right? So maybe you can speak about some of the cons with regard to community radio stations increasingly having access to Canadian content development funding.
Well, the cons I see is more about being cautious in all this. You know, protect our mission, protect our independence in all the programming and the production. That is our essence, our raison d'être.
You had mentioned that you're the director of ARC, the Association of Community Radio Stations in Quebec. Have you heard from your members about this arrangement? Are they interested in getting their own access to CCD funding as well?
It's a precedent. It's interesting to see, and it opens another way of getting funding.
To find CIBL online, visit the station at its new website, www.cibl1015.com. This is Gretchen, reporting from CKUT for Groundwire.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on Anishinaabe Territory in Thunder Bay, Ontario. Music this week was by Tanya Tagak. Headlines were written by Lindsay Nixon, Gretchen King, and Catherine Fisher. We also thank Ome Selma Rahmtula, Gennardi O'Sullivan, Mick Sweetman, and Sienna Drake. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.